says things like, "Don't you remember how soda tasted?" Zemu is what it's called.
Zemu.
Zemu.
That's very
nostalgia,
funny.
Man.
Yeah, he's like a big, like, kind of looks like a Yeti, mm-hmm. but he's got like a mechanical maw on his back that he puts, you know, the rocks on CEO's underlings into when he gets hungry.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Wild Run.
Huh. That sounds like fun.
Immortal Hulk.
Where's that movie?
That's what I'm saying. Well, that's when I was reading this with Alex, the whole time I was like, what the hell, Marvel? What are we doing? You got this crazy stuff going
all
on over
weird,
the page.
Deep cut, bizarre nonsense. Yeah. We're out here with the most pedestrian stories you can tell.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm sad.
You guys, speaking of pedestrian stories and Marvel.
Yes.
Yes.
And we being defenders of the time they really went big and did something different, Eternals. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see about how Kumail Nanjiani got sad that nobody liked Eternals?
That's too bad to hear.
Got like really depressed about how poorly it was received. Uh-oh. I guess
that is unfortunate.
I know. I haven't read like
it's not his fault.
No, come on, Kumail. Don't put that on your shoulders, bud. People were weird to him about his face looking different after he got buff.
Oh yeah,
and you know, so
yeah.
You know, they hate to see somebody win.
I saw him in a. Did I see him in a trailer for something recently?
He's in new Ghostbusters.
Yes. That's what it was. Yeah. Yeah. He walks in the Ackroyd shop.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
A little gray.
Yeah, he's going gray. That. He's looking good.
Yeah, I like it.
I do miss sort of normal human proportions, Kumail, a little bit. You know, I'm happy for him that he got a trainer and for a Marvel movie or whatever, but. He does look like an action
Marvel
figure
has
now.
Beefed up all of our schlubby friends.
Yeah, I hate it. I don't like it.
It's too bad.
You remember when actors were ugly?
Mm-hmm.
God.
Or just, you know, unique, you
or
know,
normal
yeah.
looking.
Yeah, normal
like
looking.
A Willem Dafoe type, if
Ooh,
you will.
Or, you know, sort of a Harry Dean Stanton, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Or even Diane Ladd.
Or even Nicolas Cage. Like, they let his hair be thinning in his 20s in this movie.
And that's okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Hello,
it was
everybody.
A better time.
Welcome again to the Good Trash Genrecast. We gather around a table, we discuss the films you'll never discuss in a film today's course, unless we're in a marathon or for whatever other reasons that we violate our own rules. And we are in a marathon, and we are in a David Lynch marathon, of all things. 12 years of a podcast, and we are only just now doing a director's marathon for the first time ever. Last week, we talked about the film Dune. This week, we talk about his Palme d'Or winning film, Wild at Heart, starring one Nick Cage and a Laura Dern, amongst others already mentioned.
Now, Dustin, for listeners who are newer to our ramblings, why don't you give people a window into why Lynch is like the director we would go to for our first director's marathon?
That is a question I'm not sure I could answer, other than I think kismet happened and the programmer gods or God smiled upon us, because I mean there are other directors that could be the good trash directors. And again, I think Lynch is in our category even.
Interesting. I think Carpenter is like our most covered director.
Yes.
He's probably like a true good trash director.
Right, like Cronenberg.
Yeah. But is Lynch? I'm going to go ahead and say yes. But my logic on that is sort of esoteric. Because
he is like a high art guy, but he's kitsch.
Yes, exactly. Right, exactly. Yeah. And like the kitsch is like deliberately off-putting.
Right.
And even the artsier side of him can be deliberately off-putting in sort of this genre schlock sort of way.
Yeah. I think that's probably fair.
Yeah. And again, like his roots in midnight movies with Eraserhead, like I definitely feel like, and again, like he's got pretty lurid films.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's definitely operating in trash territory.
Yeah. He's like an exploitation director who went to art school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is a good way to kind of think of him in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, well, hey, you guys, I'm still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I was drinking my coffee. Sorry. I'm Dalton. Hello.
And if you're tuning into the show for the very first time, coffee is the appropriate drink, I believe, while we're talking Lynch. But if you're tuning into the show for the very first time, dear listener, this is an analysis show, not a review show. And that does mean we're going to spoil the end of this movie, which is probably significant and will oftentimes be significant. I think David Lynch's films are probably best experienced as mysteries, best experiences as experiences. There's a weird way in which you're not ready to watch them until you've watched them, which is kind of one of the things about his filmography, I think, that's kind of interesting about him. But we're going to spoil it, and we're going to avoid spoiling it in the first part of the show, though. We're going to have a synopsis. We're going to have quick thumbs up, thumbs down reviews like you'd read on the internet. And then we're going to move on into our quick game called Expanding the Syllabus, where there may be thematic spoilers, but they're often whatever plot spoilers happen in that point are still pretty light. From there, we move on to our business, which is analysis. We have music to let you know that's when all spoiler bets are off. So just want you to know what you're getting into as you buckle up, Buttercup, into the world of David Lynch.
You know, you're right that coffee is the beverage of choice for a David Lynch marathon.
I think
so.
But
if we were in Arthur's, you know, game room right now, I would be just chain smoking. That's the other thing you need for a David Lynch movie. You need to be ripping down some nicotine.
Yeah.
There's absolutely getting geeked off tobacco.
You're not wrong.
Weed AM, as Alex Sanchez would call it.
Weed AM. That's very funny.
That's funny. Pretty good joke.
So with that, let's go ahead and begin with a synopsis of the thing that we're talking about. Arthur, do you have one of those prepared for us today?
After Sailor gets out of prison, he and his girl Lulu go on the road from North Carolina to Texas. But Lula's mom will stop at nothing to end their relationship, including hiring the eccentric hitman, Bobby Peru.
Indeed. An unsynopsizable film synopsized quite well, sir.
That's why they pay me the big bucks, bro.
That's right.
Yeah, that's
very... why he's in charge of the Patreon money.
Because he can do this stuff.
And he can buy us copies of Wild at Heart.
Which is excellent.
Because you can't stream it anywhere for free or to rent.
Nope.
No.
Rights are almost up.
I don't know what the situation is with the rights on this movie. Did anybody do any research into that?
I did not.
Why it's weird?
MGM owns it, and they got acquired by Amazon, so that's probably why.
That weird...
That ickiness. But, you know, it's not out of print or anything. You can get it from Shout Factory.
Yeah. They've released the disc, so... But for whatever reason, the streaming rights are strange on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so whatever.
Feels like Criterion may pick it up at some point, right?
They're obligated, right?
Yeah.
They've got
a good number of all of his other major works, right?
Yeah.
They have Elephant Man.
They've got Inland Empire and Blue Velvet and Lost Highway.
Right. And that's sort of like the major.
And Eraserhead.
They have Eraserhead.
And Mulholland.
Mulholland, I think there's Criterions for all of those, right?
Except for Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and, yeah,
seems like on Dune.
Firewalk
with me. Firewalk with me is on there too.
And
Dune's the probably one outlier that may not hit it.
Yeah.
But I could see Wild at Heart getting a Criterion as well.
It's a Palme d'Or winner. Like it ought to. Streaming rights are messed up. It seems like it's only a matter of time before there's a new 4K of this.
Yeah. Man, one can only hope.
And we did just cross the 30th anniversary of this film, you know, just a scant few years ago.
Oh yeah, true.
Yeah.
So, well, all right. I've seen the movie a couple of times. Both of you are virgin watchers. Is that what I assume?
Correct.
So I go to you first. Arthur, do you like Wild at Heart? Tell me why or why not.
Yeah, it's a good time, man. I'm a big Nick Cage guy anyway. And this is a kind of a fun point for him, you know, sort of the conversations around this is the movie that broke him of his method acting style that he had coming up out of the new Hollywood, obviously, as a Coppola, mm-hmm. like very familiar with that style. Mm-hmm. But Lynch is sort of throw caution to the wind, who knows what's going to happen style of filmmaking.
Apparently him and Laura Dern went on a weekend together to Las Vegas the method, but not really for fun.
So they get to know each other and be comfortable with one another, especially because of the sex scenes.
I think
this is the kind of stated anecdote, is that to be comfortable, David wanted them to go spend time together to get to know one another so that intimacy would be there, and mm-hmm. make sure she was comfortable to be able to do everything with respect to Lynch on that.
Yeah. More Elvis.
Yeah, but I mean, this is, you know, this is like that. The thing with Nick Cage now is like finding directors that know how to channel that energy. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that energy was unleashed with David Lynch, right? Like mm-hmm. it just tapped into like another plane of whatever extra dimensional being Nick Cage is.
It's like channeling the weirdness of like Vampire's Kiss, which is earlier, but it's like more focused and like a real character.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, Cage usually always makes some big choices in his movies, goes for big swings, even like Moonstruck, you know, he does with Cher. He makes choices.
Mm-hmm,
But this is definitely, I think, that moment where it's the perfect marriage of actor and director and content or story or character. I love Nick Cage. I love Laura Dern. Just one of the greats, I think. It's interesting career, right? I mean, outside of kind of Jurassic Park, she doesn't have like a mainstream sort of career in that way. She does a lot of independent art house type of stuff. And so really getting to see her and appreciating her work here, just rounding out that cast with a lot of fun. You know, I talked last week about the stock characters or stock actors, the stable that Lynch uses, and then bringing in Diane Ladd, Willem Dafoe, just some really fun stuff there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Willem Dafoe, the other kind of MVP here. Mm-hmm. Name is third on the marquee and comes in 75 minutes into the movie or something like that, right?
And is in maybe 15 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. And just absolutely knocking it out of the park as Bobby Peru.
Like the country.
Yes. Just great production design's a lot of fun, but just costuming stuff, little stuff, Cage's gear, Sailor, but Bobby Peru as well, that straight black kind of
the fringe,
very country music, Southwest that style,
sick bolo, kind of,
and those gums.
It's like a Southern fried John Waters.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what he is.
Just like a dash of Vincent Price.
Well, him and John Waters are good friends. Lynch and Waters are their pals.
That makes sense.
When they were screening Pink Flamingos, I want to say. Mm-hmm. It was double billed a lot with Eraserhead and the Midnight Circuit, and so they would present together and got to be pals.
That's tight.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things, and it's kind of like the Coens, like, you know, the violence in Lynch stuff is, it's kind of limited, but when it shows up, it hits hard. So that stuff's all real cool. The opening here with Sailor before he goes to prison, why he goes to prison for manslaughter, the scene of him from this beating he bestows upon another sort of hitman, works really well. The editing's really cool. Lynch's sort of imagery throughout, obviously a lot of connections with The Wizard of Oz, but also just the things he's doing with like color palette with some of the sex scenes and this sort of constant insert shot of matches lighting and cigarettes lighting.
The matches.
One of my favorite things here. Diane Ladd going wild with the lipstick. Just some really cool imagery. I think it's very memorable. You know, I don't know ranking it with some of the other Lynch stuff. I still think I prefer probably a couple of the other, you know, maybe A Firewalk with Me and A Blue Velvet a little more than this. But this may be one of the more memorable Lynch's.
Unforgettable.
Just because of all the imagery and just all the vision. So, yeah. Finally got around to seeing it. I've been wanting to see this one for a long time, just mostly because of my love for Nick Cage. So to kind of be able to cross this off that list was a good time, and I enjoyed it. I think Sells at least off the air that this felt a little, there are moments that felt a little long in the tooth for me, but I was also very sleepy when I watched this, so that could impact that. So, you know, I don't want to put that too much against
setting for the trip.
And there's very much a way in which this could go up in the future as far as star ratings. I could see that going up in maybe a fresher watch when I'm not falling asleep because baby woke up at 3 a.m, you know. So
that'll happen.
Yeah. But yeah, I really expected I would go for this and I did.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. Well, Dalton, did you go for it?
Well, you know me. I'm a big believer in individuality and personal freedom.
Yeah. Is that why you
individuality?
Went
to
individuality. Yeah. Well, individuality.
There's quite a bit of that.
I thought that's
on.
What you said. You were making a dude.
In various positions.
I was not doing a deliberate joke, but my mush mouth did give us quite a bit of gold there. I just, as soon as that snakeskin jacket shows up, you know you're in for a wild ride. And even before that, I mean, obviously this movie opens with such a stark moment of violence, just like within the first 5 minutes, 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it is
classical music, power mad, and murder
right away.
Yeah.
The power mad as he's killing that dude is just like so jarring.
Oh, yeah. The music in this. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, and you know, you don't really know the stakes of that scene entirely when it starts. So it's just kind of Nick Cage murdering a guy. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? What movie am I watching? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you slowly learn more about.
Which is a common response to most David Lynch.
That's fair. That's very fair. But I think as you learn more about Sailor and Lula and Lula's mom, who's played by Diane Ladd, Laura Dern's actual mother, which is so fun. Diane Ladd picking up a much deserved Oscar nomination for this performance. And so as you learn more about the relationships between these three people, like that beginning makes more sense. And again, you kind of go on this odyssey and it's just such an interesting mix of like a journey through physical space and a journey through like psychic space, right? Like it's this kind of crazy mix of road movie and sort of journey inward, which I think is, you know, what really draws me to this movie is the ways in which it's kind of tying together the road movie and something a little trippier, a little more Lynchian, a little more, you know, reality kind of bleeding together, and memory and fantasy and real life all kind of mixing together. And it just really all comes together. Arthur, you've already mentioned some of my favorite stuff, the costumes here, the colors, the insert shots of the matches and cigarettes, which, boy, was it hard to not want to get up and go smoke during this movie. Oh, my God.
Fair enough.
Just like, whew, just constantly just cigarettes. You know, we lamented a lot over the last few years about the death of love, relationships, and sex in American films. Mm. Boy, it's 1990s wild at heart.
Lynch has your back.
Lynch has got you. If you think movies don't have enough sex, Lynch has got you covered, because Lula and Sailor be banging. Mm-hmm. But it's like such a nice relationship. Mm-hmm. As much as like, there might be maybe too many sex scenes, it still like totally sells the relationship of like these crazy kids who just can't keep their hands off of each other. And like, more than those scenes, you get these really nice scenes of like pillow talk, where they're just sort of chilling out, talking about their lives and their outlooks. And it really like develops these characters in this relationship in a way that feels real, even when you have these two, I don't know a nice way to say this. I was going to say coastal elites, but I didn't know if I could get the sarcasm in my voice right to make it clear I was doing a bit. But these folks who are not from the South doing these kind of Southern caricatures, like, mm-hmm. they do manage to turn them into real characters. Yeah. Like, they still, it feels like a Lynch movie. So, like, I think the artifice of the performance is, like, part of a Lynch movie. And I think that's why Cage is such a great fit for Lynch's, you know, the worlds that he creates. Just in terms of the ways in which Cage kind of goes weird and goes big with his choices, kind of really fits.
Like, you know, he does Elvis like Kurt Russell does John Wayne in Death Proof.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah,
and it really just works.
Yeah,
doing mm-hmm. that. Yeah,
yeah. And you hear the Laura Dern tell about Lynch's direction, which is just, yeah, I know, already made the joke. Yeah. More Elvis, more Marilyn Monroe,
more bubblegum.
Yeah, more bubblegum, more sexy, more dumb. Just like, whatever, David, that rocks. I that's such fun direction that he's just like, more of this. I love it. And that's kind of the joy of this movie, is like, there's always more. There's always more craziness around the corner. Is it upsetting?
Yes.
Boy, howdy, is it. More than once. And in some ways that are deeply confusing. One of them involving Crispin Glover. If you think Nicolas Cage is one of our weirdest performers, I got a gentleman named Crispin to introduce you to.
Cockroaches in his underwear.
That's right. Cockroaches on his anus. What an image. What a string of words for a film to contain. This movie does bring out the gore hound in me. Mm. There is something like really, really stark and realistic about the violence in this film, and yet dialed up to 11 in a way that makes it feel hyper real and a little movie. Mm-hmm. It really is a good mix of like jarring, and like violence is scary and gross and bad, and yet like has that the really, really bright red colors, the really sort of extra squishy heads, like
it invites the voyeuristic, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it gets like, I don't know, it has its cake and eats it too, mm-hmm. a little bit, in a way that I think is really impressive. There are some choices here that I'm confused by, that kind of hold me back, like Isabella Rossellini's wig. Mm-hmm. What are we doing here?
Rita Hayworth.
Is that okay? Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think literally is, I think it's because he used her in Blue Velvet, you know, in her natural hair color, which was, she was wearing a wig in that as well, yeah. for a large portion mm-hmm. of the film. But yeah. I began, she was his ingenue. So I think he's doing an Orson Welles bit when he, Platinum Blonde's Rita Hayworth for,
just
Shanghai.
Bleach Isabella Rossellini's hair.
Shanghai.
Yeah. I don't, it just is so weird to have her, mm-hmm. like her natural hair sticking out from underneath the wig. It's such a choice.
Yeah.
And her makeup's bad, too. And
sure.
Again, that feels like a deliberate choice.
Yeah, I think that's all supposed to be.
Yeah.
Because in the book, I think she's supposed to be a pretty rundown character, right?
Gotcha. I hadn't gotten that far in the book. Yeah.
Something I'd read is that that character's supposed to be fairly...
And I got her mixed up.
Ugly is the right word, but very...
Yeah.
I mean...
Trashy, to put it ungenerously.
If we think of the other... woman we see here.
Juanita. Is it Juana or Juanita?
I think it's Juana.
Oh, by Grace Zabrinsky's character. Yeah.
Who I thought... Very Isabella
Rossellini, right.
For a second, yeah, because they do have similar looks, yeah. And then there's the, this might be just like a restoration issue of, you know, the Blu-ray, but like there's such a stark color difference in Nicholas's face and like the broken nose makeup that he has. Oh, sure. It's just, there's some weird,
like high def is not always serving us.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, the grain of celluloid helps hide things sometimes. So I don't know. There's and it's hard to tell like what's a choice, what's again like just a restoration difference. But it, overall, I'm fully on board with this movie. I think one of the best choices is, Lula's driving and it's just like horrific piece of news after horrific piece of news.
Oh man, yeah.
And she says, "Sailor, get me some music on this radio right now." It's so good. And then they find Power Mad on the radio, and then it cuts to this classical music, and they have this like kind of very classical Hollywood, you know, whimsical romantic embrace as they're actually listening to Power Mad on the side of the road and dancing like maniacs. And it's golden hour, and it looks incredible. And that's Wild at Heart, baby.
Yeah,
that and, you know, Bobby Peru getting decapitated by Buckshot. That's Wild at Heart.
Yes.
What a picture. Dustin, you're a great lover of this film.
I am.
This is one of your favorite Lynches, right?
Yes. A flavor.
They're all
his favorite.
Yeah, I don't care for Dune much. But you know, we talked about that last week.
You really would be one of those annoying celebs when Letterboxd is on the red carpet and you'd be like, "Oh, I can't pick four."
Right.
All of the David Lynches.
Just pick four movies. Come on.
It is hard to do, but this would be in the rotating four of my favorite David Lynch movies.
Okay.
Okay. I can say that much. It would rotate in and out, I think, depending on what I'd seen most recently.
Sure.
So as of having just recently, very recently, seen this movie, I like it a whole bunch because it's incredible. There is this interesting sense in which Lynch's movies are dark, disturbing, terribly, terribly frightening, and also incredibly optimistic. There's always this sort of possibility for hope, you know, love being sort of the all powerful force in this film, the love between Sailor and Lula. And I think that's really the thing I really like about his aesthetic. And it is that sort of coffee meets pie thing that other critics and analysands have said about the work of David Lynch, is that in order to appreciate beauty, you have to know just what it stands in stark contrast to. And then by knowing the bitterness of a lot of what happens in the world. And so there's a sense in which the world of Wild at Heart is the real world, but dialed to 11. I think that's an interesting thing to say, is that it is this sort of Oz, this other place, this different place than our experience, but it's not so unlike, again, the doppelgangers that are present, the ways in which it sort of mirrors and reflects on our world. I think that incisive cultural critique is sort of what sustains him as an important filmmaker. The most important visual artist of the second half of the 20th century into the 21st century.
I mean, there's like a big director's roundtable in like 2007, I think, and pretty much everybody there. I'll get some more details on this gathering of directors, but yeah, basically he's sort of a director's director.
Yeah.
It's like widely regarded as the GOAT of the 20th century.
The first half of the 20th century is Alfred Hitchcock, and second half, or from 77 on into the 21st century, it's been David Lynch.
It's, you know, he's not as prolific as, say, a Scorsese, but his name rings out as notably.
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of, I don't know, maybe Coppola is kind of a guy to pair him with, just because they both have, you know, 10 movies or so. I mean, I'm stretching Lynch's filmography and compressing Coppola's filmography.
Yeah.
But, you know, 10 to 12 movies or so.
Roughly comparable.
Yeah, and they kind of start at the same time. Obviously, Coppola, like, works on a much larger scale than Lynch and has, like, more mainstream success. But I think they're, like, they have similar sensibilities of, like, genre and art kind of mixing. But yeah, I'm
well, there's something
you.
Operatic about both of them as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, is the emotion at the register is always cranked.
It's interesting to me, though, that he's not really thought of as one of those new Hollywood guys.
Right.
You know, despite kind of being one of those, you know, going to through the AFI Institute and, you know, sort of coming up as a film school guy, but, you know, didn't go to one of the UC schools.
Well, because the new Hollywood guys always went back to the studios.
Yeah.
And then that's the thing. Lynch has that opportunity in with De Laurentiis and says, no, after that experience, he goes indie before indie's a thing, really. Well, I mean, indie's always a thing, but you know, that sort of indie wood moment that begins with Sex, Lies, and Videotapes from Soderbergh. He sort of precedes that and plays on it in a different register all the way through. So yeah, this movie sort of fits in that. The performances, as you've already mentioned, are great. As Arthur was saying, and we were all kind of saying, the musical choices throughout the film are just absolutely incredible. I love the idea of a world where you go to a metal bar to hear Power Mad, and everyone will also sing every single word to an Elvis standard. This is a world I want to live in. Like, sign me up for that. Seems incredible. Just the sort of weirdness of Lynch is also weirdly reflective of weirdness that we do encounter in life. I mean, that's the thing, is like, you see these hyper overblown characters, but we insulate ourselves from a lot of that. Our white picket fences and tulips are sort of there to avoid those encounters because, man, the world is wild at heart and weird on top. I mean, there really is some truth to that kind of, you know, observation.
Hey, boy, howdy. Yeah, that's a line that's going to stick with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, love it a lot. It is so very 90s, but I'm kind of there for that as well. So there you go, dear listener. Our views are generally pro regarding the David Lynch film Wild at Heart. We're going to move on to the next part of our show, which is called Expanding the Syllabus, and Dalton's going to tell you what that's all about.
That's right, Dustin. This is the part of the show where we deliver on the promise of our premise. We're going to talk about the films you would not discuss in a film studies course, and we're going to do it in a film studies type way. However, as you have been informed, we're breaking our rules and are talking about a film you probably would discuss in a film studies course. The game remains the same. We're going to program a syllabus centered around Wild at Heart and try to, you know, develop a class that would tease out the themes that we're interested in, the ideas we're interested in, stuff like that. Also, I did go ahead and go to my research. It was a 2007 Guardian Critics Roundtable.
Yeah.
And it was like him, Scorsese, Soderbergh, or no, him, Scorsese, the Coens, Soderbergh, Malick. I think we're the top five.
That checks out, yeah.
But this is like 2007 is when this roundtable came together. And I mean, yeah, he is... Like him or hate him, like, he's a very important American filmmaker, and I think our classes will hopefully bear that out.
Yes. Do you have a syllabus prepared, my friend?
I do. I thought about, you know, teasing out this idea I mentioned in my review about sort of the ways in which Wild at Heart is kind of a psychic journey, sort of a journey into the mind and into the hearts of people. So I was thinking of things, obviously, The Wizard of Oz, of course, Dune. David Lynch, both David Lynch and Denis Villeneuve from last week, I think actually does pair really well with Wild at Heart. Also thought about The Matrix,
of course. I think Paul Atreides is definitely a Dorothy character.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so yeah.
Or a Neo character, of course, right, as a messianic figure. Mm-hmm. So I think all of these fit together, but I decided to go a different direction, a related but different direction, and I'm doing something I'm calling American Odysseys and Oddities, which is sort of these sort of psychedelic road trip movies that... however they kind of tackle the arcane or the mystical or the weird, they are dealing with it in some way. They're all like positing that America is haunted and like a nebulous place of magic and terror. And so I think all of these movies are road trips, but they're road trips with like a weird edge to them. So the films that I've cobbled together, but I think they're films and TV show book I've got so far for this this kind of idea is, of course, our this week's From Wild at Heart, and then Ari Aster's Beau Is Afraid,
sure,
Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers, the Coens' Oh Brother Where Art Thou, and then Neil Gaiman's American Gods, are sort of the key texts that I've kind of assembled for this. And I think you could easily come up with some more films. California with a K,
sure.
I think that's one that fits in here.
Haven't seen that movie since like it was first aired on HBO.
I think I it was like
gosh
I think I saw it on Netflix when for Netflix streaming first started. I haven't seen it in probably 10-15 years, but it's kind of cool. It's kind of a fun road movie, but again, like, very dark and weird. Maybe even Joyride, another kind of schlocky film that might fit in here, you know, just kind of a classic running from a trucker, you know, riff on Duel. But you've got the great, oh my god, I can't think of his name, but the guy that does the voice for Candy Cane. I can't think of the name of the voice actor for the scary trucker in Joyride.
It's Ted Levine.
Ted Levine. Thank you, Arthur. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I know. I couldn't think of
Buffalo Bill.
James Gum. I couldn't think of any of those names. It was all falling out of my head. But yeah, I think Joyride, even though it's kind of schlocky and not quite.
It's a good time.
It's a good time. And it's not quite all the way in the sort of pseudo mystical lane I'm talking about, but it's got that hard kind of dark edge and sort of that that menace that I think all of these, even Oh Brother Where Art Thou, which is like very light and funny, there is this weird edge to it.
Yes.
That like this is a cursed land that you're wandering. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think all of these, and it's not, stories get.
And none of those films, I think, overwhelmingly are sort of in a judgmental phase, too.
No,
about the weirdness. I mean, there's a certain joyfulness in celebrating the strangeness.
Or even, you know, even a place of judgment about, like, sort of the haunted quality of the land they're wandering. It just is sort of a fact of the place that they're in. I just thought of another story that would fit here and came and went in a moment and I already forgot it. I really think that there's something here and you could probably tease out even more films. But yeah, there's all of the ones that I picked so far, I think you're right, are kind of reveling in the weirdness in some ways, right?
Yeah.
And kind of really, you know, just exploring the American wilderness and of both like the ideology and culture of this country and the history and just sort of the dark underbelly that exists is sort of looked at in all these films. But again, like, as you said, there's some joy in all of these films that kind of look, even something as grim as Natural Born Killers as like a real, like, I don't know, energy to it.
Right. Yeah.
Can either of you think of any plugins for this? I'm really mad that the one that I just thought of came and
I mean,
went
the
out
most normy one that comes to mind is Thelma and Louise.
Oh, sure.
Which is super
sure.
normy, but it's still kind of got some of that strangeness there.
For sure. For sure. Oh, True Romance.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Duh.
And
which True is very similar to this film.
True Romance. So there's a fun little like rabbit hole you can go down to the David Lynch ripoff, the Twin Peaks slash Wild at Heart ripoff moment that goes on. And so Natural Born Killers kind of goes in that category. So does True Romance. The TV series Wild Palms.
No, I don't know
about
James
Belushi. I watched a bit of it last week. It is not great, but it's okay. It's got a lot of style. There's a rhinoceros in the bottom of a swimming pool. A dry swimming pool, sort of like the horse in the bedroom kind of imagery. And so it's got some arresting images. Oliver Stone produces that one as well. Okay. And so Tarantino and Stone are kind of this sort of interesting place where they're kind of doing Lynchy kind of things, but also doing different stuff there. So,
oh, you know what? From Dusk Till Dawn.
Sure.
I think fits in here.
Yes.
Yeah. Speaking of Tarantino and, you know, his cohort. Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking about this class, but it's one of the ones I've been most excited by in a while.
Sounds like a good time.
Yeah. What about you? We got to do Arthur.
We got to do Arthur. Yeah.
You were thinking about road movies too a little bit at one point.
I was thinking of
crime couples.
Crime couple, or not necessarily just crime couples. It was just, you know, it was this kind of bizarre line of star-crossed lover versus and crime couple because. I don't know that, you know, Lula is with this guy breaking parole, but she never feels like a criminal, you know, in that way, kind of along for the ride, and even him breaking parole doesn't feel like that big of a, you know what I mean? Like, he's just, let's go.
Yeah.
And so we know he's probably done some shady stuff in the past, obviously, besides
man's
laughter.
We gotta get away from
laughter.
North Carolina if we can be together, though. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea.
And I, too, would want to get away from Diane Ladd painting lipstick all over her face, probably.
Correct.
I mean, she seems pretty controlling.
Keep me away from Cape Fear.
Yeah.
Why would you call a place Cape Fear?
You know what? It's a good question. It's a good question.
You know, I'm just asking the questions.
So, yeah, I'm thinking about those ideas of couples and just kind of star-crossed lover type stuff. But we'd actually kick off things with a song, a duet from Ray Charles and Willie Nelson called Seven Spanish Angels, which is a tale of a outlaw kind of on his last moment and his girl who's going to...
I don't believe I know this track.
Face the hunters, even though it's going to bring her down as well. So it's kind of Romeo and Juliet moment of you're dying, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory kind of a thing alongside you. It's a really cool song.
Fun pull.
Yeah,
well
it's
done.
A good song. And from there, we're going to look at Nicholas Ray's They Live by Night, which kind of lays the groundwork for this idea of the outlaw couple or the couple on the run moment. Obviously, we've already mentioned Malick earlier in your roundtable. I think we talked about Badlands. Spacek and Douglas here. No.
Martin Sheen.
They're the same person, I think. Badlands is just a good time. And then just, you know, Spacek kind of getting in over her head on, in this ride along with Sheen's character as they go. Do some deplorable things across the country. So there is that tie of the kind of outlaw couple and this Odyssey thing that they do kind of birth together.
For sure.
Which takes me to Natural Born Killers as well. Okay. Oliver Stone here. As Lewis and Woody are going cross country doing things and violent things.
Having peyote trips. Yeah. Thinking about their terrible childhoods, you know, as a sitcom.
Yeah.
That gag with Rodney Dangerfield, that whole sequence is bananas.
Bananas.
Yeah.
We'd probably tame things down, though, and we'd go take a look at David Lowery's Old Man and the Gun.
Nice.
Yes. Which feels kind of a little more tonally in line with, I think, Sailor and Lulu's relationship. You know, Redford's character's not a bad guy. He just likes the thrill of the job. And Sissy Spacek, again, kind of an intertextual relationship back to Badlands there. As a fun, as his kind of romantic interest. I also thought a lot about Baby Driver. I actually thought about Edgar Wright quite a bit here. But Baby Driver, we would take a look at, especially kind of where it reconciles at the end of that movie. But as I was watching this, kind of thinking of the setup of Sailor and all the kind of hitmen that Marietta sent after him. I kept thinking about Scott Pilgrim versus the Wolf.
Sure. Yeah, okay. Sure.
And so that's not quite an outlaw couple thing, but there was just that kind of... Sailor's got to face these challenges for Lula. And so, like, I thought a lot about Scott Pilgrim because of that. Nice. And so that's what we'd take a look at, I think.
I like that. That's a fun class. Yeah, this sort of our modern star-crossed lovers.
Yeah.
What about you, Dust?
I think I would do this. This film won the Palme d'Or in 1990.
It did.
And received many boos at Cannes.
Yeah.
Look, just a sidebar. Do you know how much more fun the Oscars would be if people actually just went balls out like they do at
saying, if people if got rowdy,
like 80% of that room had booed when Green Book won and gave, like, I don't know, some weirdo nominee a 5-minute standing ovation. Like,
right, yeah, because they recognize the artistry, yeah.
Well, get as drunk as you get at the Golden Globes.
And then go for it.
I heard...
what are we doing?
Mulaney...
Did you see his bit?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. The governor's ball speech.
So
and he read a bit of Pacino in a Playboy interview talking about being high on Valium when he was nominated for Serpico. And he was just thinking, God, I hope they don't call my name. He couldn't get up. He like fully was like, I cannot get on stage right now. I have been eating Valium like they're candy because I thought this was an hour-long show.
That is great.
Yeah.
But yeah, what if people got really rowdy at the dang Oscars? I agree.
So I think a class on the awards and the big festivals, like film festivals as a course. And so you would the big European three, obviously Cannes, Berlin and Venice. And then the other two big international film festivals are the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF, and then Sundance in Utah would be sort of our five sections, modules that we'd break it out. We do some history. We talk about the foundation of each of them individually. Fun fact about Cannes, it was the sort of first big festival was the Venice Film Festival. And then Berlin followed pretty quickly thereafter. And if you know something about Europe in the 1930s, fascists ran those countries. And
in this economy?
Anyway, there's a number of reasons why that sort of stuff takes place. And they were putting, their ministers of propaganda and the heads of state, Mussolini and Hitler, were putting their thumbs on the scale against or for individual films because of ideological purposes. And the French said, nah, we're going to go down the French Riviera, and we're going to do our own festival down in Cannes because they did not want to see. Well, they created a category for best documentary, even though it didn't exist, so Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia could win. That was sort of the straw that broke the celluloid's back in this particular story. And so that's the birth of Cannes. And it's a juried award show rather than a voting body. And so the jury is selected every year, usually headed by some sort of film celebrity. Mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg, famously. Spike Lee.
Yeah.
From just a couple weeks ago. Yeah. My brain said, no, not Spike Jones, it's Spike Lee. And then I had to
realize you had to break down. Spike Jones.
Yeah.
And has he been the judge? I think he's been on the jury, right?
Spike Lee has.
No, Jones.
Jones, not that I know of.
Okay.
I haven't. I mean, honestly, this class for me to teach it, I'd have to do some research and some work to do it. But so we would talk about that. And the films that we would show, I think, are going to be some of the interesting sort of interludes. So at points, there are sort of just one movie from every country won. For a little while there, and then they went from a Palme d'Or to a Grand Prix. Grand Prix is kind of the second prize now. And then they went back to the Palme d'Or, then back to Grand Prix, and eventually they go finally for the the Palme d'Or as the big prize for that. Marty is the first film to win that with Ernest Borgnine. And so that would be, I think, obviously an important film to watch in the history of it. Then I want to look at a couple of interesting ties and shared awards, I think would be the way I would go through it. So the first one I would look at is in the year of our Lord, 1961. I was going to say 60, but it is 61, in which the long absence from Henry Colpi from France holds the title. This is the first time it ever happened.
Okay.
With Viridiana from Louis Buñuel.
Okay.
Famous for its excellent Last Supper sequence, but with not Last Supper type people at the table. And so just thinking about that sort of division there, and one is a bit more traditional, commercial, and one is quite a bit more experimental, the Buñuel one being the more experimental one of those options. And so I think that's a good first place to go to. I mean, there's a lot of interesting winners over the years. Francis Ford Coppola is in that rare three category of winning three times. I mean, there's lots of fun stuff to go at. I think 69's winner, it would be worth watching as well, Lindsay Anderson's If, because it's in direct response, because the festival was not held in 1968. To hold solidarity with the student protests and walkouts and strikes that were going on in France. And so they didn't have a 68 at all. And then this super rebellious, you know, bring down the establishment film like Lindsay Anderson's If would be a good example of that. The other interesting shared one I want to look at is the first time a woman ever wins a Palme d'Or for a film, and that is The Piano from Jane Campion, which held the title with Farewell My Concubine, which is the first Asian film also to win. And so it's an interesting year of first there. And so thinking about the makeup of that particular jury and why those decisions are made, and having an interesting discussion there. I will not show the film where I teach, for various reasons, but I think we'll have to talk about Blue is the Warmest Color as well, which fascinatingly enough is a film that is, there's one of the rules attached to the winning of the Palme d'Or is you're ineligible for any of the other prizes. Can't win director, can't win actor or actress.
I think that's nice that they spread the love like that.
Yeah, which is a great thing. And so Steven Spielberg and the jury decided to award the Palme d'Or to the director and the two stars. Of Blue is the Warmest Color, because he said if you were off 3% on the casting, it wouldn't have worked. Léa Seydoux and Adele Arkopoulos are just too great to award them, which absolutely infuriated the director, who then went on to auction off his Palme d'Or just so he can pay for his next movie, which I think is just
That's very fun
history there for you all. And so just the history of Cannes, and which is probably the most rich next to the Oscars as far as history there. Obviously, Oscars, we can talk about snubs and it's strange picks to win a year when clearly a much more important or influential picture comes out. And so there's a lot of interest to be had with those conversations with that. But that's how I would teach this film, which was a super divisive winner the year that it won. So that's how I would do it. I think your syllabus just got much longer, dear listener. Let's move on. I think it's now time to get down to business. It's business. It's business time. I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. It's business. That's right, dear listener. And that business is, as always, analysis. Is there room for analysis of a film by David Lynch?
I have no notes. I wrote down no analysis notes. I'm for this whole marathon, I'm going very freewheeling.
Well, let's start with The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
That's his big thing, right? Mm. And we see multiple allusions here, some just directly name-checking, but we see Lula tapping her red shoes. Mm-hmm. We get an appearance from Glinda, the Good Witch.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we also Diane Ladd as that, the Wicked Witch of the West. Yeah,
we see that flying through quite a bit.
Wild at heart, Wizard of Oz. The two just went together to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. What's his? You've seen Lynch Oz, which came out last year, was one of your best movies of the year.
Love that movie.
What's Lynch's deal with The Wizard of Oz, bro?
Well, I think it's a touchstone for him. And one of the things that's interesting about the choices to connect this to The Wizard of Oz is...
And it's primarily just the movie, right?
Not
the
book. It's just the movie. It's not present at all in the book.
Mm-hmm. I mean, no, I'm sorry. For Lynch, is it just the 39 Wizard of Oz, or does he also pull from the book, from Baum's book as well?
No, for far as I know, no.
Okay.
Yeah, far as I know, he's very much influenced by it. There's a quote that he is quoted to have said in the documentary Lynch Oz, where it says, "There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about The Wizard of Oz." And you do see that. I mean, there is this sort of nightmare journey that the characters go into. And, you know, really, truly, if you think about The Wizard of Oz, if you stop to think about it, yes, there are Munchkins singing songs, and yes, they're the Lollipop Guild, and yes, there's a Yellow Brick Road, and a Tin Man, and a Scarecrow, and a Cowardly Lion, who's kind of mean at first, but turns out to be pretty nice. You set that stuff aside and start thinking about Dorothy arrives in this place having just crushed a woman to death with a house and then sweared upon revenge from her sister, mm-hmm. Who is terrifying and powerful.
Who later makes her and her friends OD on opium.
Right.
Yeah. Insane story.
Insane. And then being sent to assassinate her by another political figure.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a dark, and then the kidnapping by the Blue Flying Monkeys. I mean, mm-hmm. we could go on and on. It's a scary, scary story.
Yeah.
And her constant pursuit of the mystery. She keeps going. She's like, no, I'm sitting right here till help comes, which is sort of the natural, more human response, or I will hang out in Munchkin Land, which seems to be a pretty okay place to be. Like, these are all the options. But rather, she sort of longs for something outside of her home and then goes down this journey in the pursuit of this mystery, which is full of fear and full of scary, but also full of joy and good friends to find along the way. I mean, The Wizard of Oz is a road movie. And so much of Lynch's work, you know, whether it be Twin Peaks or Mulholland Drive or Blue Velvet or Wild at Heart, what we're talking about right now, very much kind of tell those stories. Another suggestion that's made in the documentary, specifically in Wild at Heart, is it gives us kind of a shorthand for what's going on. That when we understand that Diane Ladd is the Wicked Witch of the West, then we don't really need a whole lot more. Because, you know, I don't know. I mean, certainly we understand the idea, nobody's good enough for my baby, you know, kind of parenting stuff. Mm-hmm. So we get that little piece there. But after that, the fact that she is just on the very edge of insanity, we don't have to know why. We don't have to know what happened. We
learn enough, right? Yeah. Like, she's culpable in the death of her husband and now her boyfriend by the same guy. Mm-hmm. She's like, let the same dude murder the last two men in her life because she's drawn to him for some reason.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, again, we don't need any more, but she is the Wicked Witch.
Yeah.
We're done. We're good. You know, and
just like, we don't need to know more about Bobby Peru. He's a Marine Corps vet and the devil.
Yes.
That's all you need to know.
What more is necessary? Correct. And so I think that's a lot of where the connective tissue kind of comes from. Mm-hmm. These kinds of journeys, these other worlds that help us to recognize and reconcile ourselves to the world that we are in, which does seem normal, but it actually is kind of, again, with these doppelgangers and, you know, this sort of repeated cast that happens in The Wizard of Oz and also happens in much of Lynch's work, this sort of idea that you recognize these types and what are otherwise normal kind of people, but there's this scary or strange or bizarre mystery also sort of surrounding you at all times.
Well, I think that's the role things like the story of Cousin Del and the radio reports of, you know, mayhem and murder. Mm-hmm. I think like that's the role these two things fill, right? Is to kind of like add texture to the world and show you the ways in which this is turned up a little bit from our reality, and yet it's exactly like our reality. Mm-hmm. You can't turn on the radio without hearing some horrible thing. And is it, you know, it's always a question of, are these horrible things happening all the time for some reason? Are we just hearing about it because if it bleeds, it leads? You know, there's all sorts of questions you have to ask yourself about why we have a news media that's obsessed with, you know, death and true crime and violence and mayhem. And this is not a new thing. This goes back decades, you know, a century or so, really. And at the same token, you have, I mean, we've all got a Cousin Del, right? Like, every family has a person who like has mental health struggles that nobody really knew how to deal with, or has, you know, special needs that, you know, especially in this part of the country, like if you're not in a, you know, a more woke place.
I was going to say efficient health system.
Yeah. If you're not in a state, I'm not even thinking internationally, just thinking about the United States. If you're not in a, you know, major metropolitan area that has like a culture of mental health care, like you might as well be on the fucking moon. Yeah. Like there's just nobody's going to help you, even in your own family, because they're not going to know what to do.
Right.
They're, you know, have divorced themselves from questions of mental health.
Well, they're
going to
hide and subterraneize and and sort of remove it from. And then, you know, there are no encounters with the strange.
And well, when you try to ignore the strange will find you, right? Yes. And that's, I don't know, Dell is just sort of, you know, is it a weird, you know, vignette just so we can get some Crispin Glover oddity? Sure. But it, like, kind of, as Lula says, that she's, like, painting a picture for Sailor of, you know, the things that lurk in the hearts of man, mm-hmm. right? It's a weird interlude, but mm-hmm. I think it says a lot about the film, and the same with the car sequence with the you know, the radio reports. Mm-hmm. I think they're of a piece with each other, sort of the texture.
And again, there are these sort of like horrific things. I think a lot about the car accident that they come mm-hmm. upon, you know, when they first are arriving in Texas.
The bad omen.
Versus the weird guy at the bar who just really hates pigeons, which is a much longer and much funnier vignette in the book. But they've sped up his voice to sort of make him even more quirky and strange. But just he's been to prison for shooting pigeons. He's shot thousands of pigeons.
Wow.
You know, and you can't operate a firearm in the city limits like that.
No.
And so
no,
it's a wild thing. And again, sort of, but it's benign in this sense, right?
Another Lynchian sort of proclivity that you already kind of alluded to earlier is this idea of what goes on outside the white picket fence, right? Mm-hmm. And it is that idea of questioning the American dream. And we kind of see this, I think, birthed out of, I mean, the kind of new Hollywood, you know, American new wave, whatever you want to call that kind of period, when we get the introduction of like the ultra violence of Arthur Penn and a Sam Peckinpah, mm-hmm. and then moving into the new Hollywood and really the kind of rise of Lynch and the sort of more cynical attitudes after Vietnam.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, the fallout of Watergate, Vietnam, the war on drugs.
And so we see this obviously in Blue Velvet, which is, you know, kind of opens with that great, with the gardening bit, and mm-hmm. then getting into the bugs and the insects and the underbelly of what's going on underneath the white picket fence. And then obviously this is a big part of Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. And it's really the heart of here. I mean, we are outside the white picket fence the entire time we're with Sailor and Lula, and it goes, you know, the Wild Heart or Weird on Top, and looking at, there are people like this in the world. This mm-hmm. this, you know, this real world isn't as clean and cut as whatever they're selling you, this corporate dream, this American dream, this mm-hmm. nuclear family. Like, this world is much bigger and weirder and bizarre and sometimes dangerous than that.
And for all its surrealism, it's a really realistic look at, you know, sort of the 50s especially. Mm-hmm. That's sort of this idealized age of Americana that Lynch uses as a touchstone, because mm-hmm. it produces Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley. It produces incredible cars and this mm-hmm. great sort of look and the sense of individuality and personal freedom. Like, these are all kind of excellent things, but it also has this darker edge that there are beneficiaries and then there are losers in that conversation. And it doesn't shy away from either of those things. That's what I mean by being realistic. It, mm-hmm. it looks at, again, you know, Leland Palmer is a 50s dad. Mm-hmm. And he's a great dad, except for when he's not.
When he's the worst dad.
When he's the worst kind of possible dad, right? Yeah. And so there's sort of that thing going on, that we've got Elvis, but we also have, you know, a hyper-regressive, you know, possession sort of ideas of parenting and, you know, abuse and mm-hmm. neglect and this stuff that is also part and parcel of that decade.
And Wild at Heart, too, we have Power Mad, right? It's mm-hmm. it much like Blue Velvet. Like, this film exists in sort of a nebulous non-decade. Mm-hmm. Like, it is definitively the 90s, and yet it is so much the 50s. And I think Wild keeps mixing the titles up. Blue Velvet does a similar thing with the 80s. It's mm-hmm. just like showing this kind of core of 50s Norman Rockwell Americana that, like, is at the heart of both of these movies. And he's kind of like looking at the late 20th century as the true face of that earlier decade in some ways, which I think is, I don't know, an interesting feature of like what he gets up to once he kind of gets the clout to do whatever he wants post, you know, Elephant Man and Dune. And like, and that's what was so interesting watching this film. You know, I didn't watch Blue Velvet between last week and this week, but, you know, obviously there's the filmographies, Dune, Blue Velvet, this, mm-hmm. and it is a really interesting 3-movie run, because I have seen Blue Velvet in the past. So it is really interesting to see, as you said last week, like, Dune is sort of this interesting nexus point of, like, what could have happened in Lynch's filmography, and is sort of the event that makes him kind of stay indie, and as you said, kind of trailblaze in the indie wood way that Soderbergh and Tarantino would kind of, you know, follow and suit, and Kevin Smith to some extent.
Sure, yeah.
All these guys would kind of follow suit. But it is interesting to see him really digging into, you know, he's just such a little weirdo. He's a little freak. He's so normal. He's apple pie, cherry pie, and I don't watch it on your phone, and I love painting, but he
loves a good hamburger.
But he's a horny little freak who's been married like 5 times and has a different kid with each of his wives. You know what I mean? Like, he's a complicated guy. Mm-hmm. And he's from Montana, but also he's really into TM. He's trying to catch the big fish, baby. Yeah, I'm so interested in his kind of his non-decade thing that he always seems to be doing, because that seems to be a common feature of all of his work, is that time and place are sort of nebulous, right? Like, Mulholland Drive is definitively Los Angeles. Eraserhead's definitively
Philadelphia.
Is it specifically Philadelphia in the text?
Yeah, well, not in the text.
That's what I mean, though.
Directly reacting to his time in Philadelphia.
Sure, but I guess what I mean is, like, even the L.A. of Mulholland Drive feels like
old Hollywood,
and yet like dark Hollywood, like the underbelly of Hollywood, like a Hollywood that is weirder than the real Hollywood in some ways, and yet is an accurate representation of it. And I know I'm kind of talking about all of his movies together, but I just bring them all up because I think Wild at Heart really sort of explores this method of his of like time and place kind of. Yes, they're grounded in sort of a moment in a location, but there's something sort of ethereal and like eternal about like the way he depicts places. Does that make sense?
It does.
Well, yeah. And if we're thinking of Lynch as auteur, and I think one of our true kind of modern auteurs in Lynch, right? It is one of the kind of tenets is that theme, that running thread through the work. And I think that's the thing. Mm-hmm. And bringing up those other movies is important to be able to identify that.
And I think this movie is unique in the filmography because, you know, you don't want to sort of go too hard and say, well, I want to talk more about Lost Highway. I want to talk more about, you know, this other. It does seem like, alongside Lost Highway, now that I mention it, this is the sort of less gentle Lynch. There's a certain softness, you know, you mentioned this sort of ethereal quality. There's a sonic ethereal quality that kind of permeates Blue Velvet, the Twin Peaks universe, and Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. And this movie and Lost Highway are his metal movies. And anyway, I mean, now Marilyn Manson is going to make an appearance in Lost Highway if we watch it. And the way in which he wants us to see at all the angles, you know, and so he does. He's able to sort of evolve as an artist.
It's interesting how he is interested in 90s music, whether it's Manson and Lost Highway or Nine Inch Nails and Twin Peaks: The Return or Power Mad and this. It's like he's
Power Mad's probably more 80s if you're going to name their genre. But
that's kind of thrash speed metal is very late 80s, but still like. He just isn't a guy that you would think would be into all of these things. But the fact that he is like kind of into heavy music and industrial music of the late 20th century.
As much as he is into doo-wop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in a great mix. Like the idea of this metal club where everybody will sing an Elvis standard with this guy that just beat up a dude for flirting with his girlfriend. Like, it's just like, okay, cool. Why not?
I'm there for it.
Yeah, I'm right there for it. But I get what you mean, though, about like using sort of heavy music to give the film a hard edge, which I think is really effective. I mean, again, he comes out swinging in that opening scene of, you know, putting the thrash guitars under, well, him thrashing this dude to death. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're so right, though, that this has got a real... Is meanness the right word
in some ways? One of his preoccupations, and again, this runs through all of his films, but I think he really highlights it in this one and in Lost Highway. The idea of the violence men do to women is always sort of one of his preoccupations. Mm-hmm. And he does not flinch from depicting violence to women, but he will go ahead and comment on it. You know, there's a way in which the films itself seem to say, then this, see, you know, it's sort of a way in which it rubs America's nose in its own misogyny, right? And I think the punctuation with the metal here is part of how he sort of helps us to see the abrasiveness of it all. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. I'm glad you bring up sort of his preoccupation with the the violence that men do to women, because that's sort of what, like, one of his harshest critics, Roger Ebert, was kind of a, you know, a big detractor of this film when it won at Cannes, big detractor of Blue Velvet, but later a big fan of Mulholland Drive. So, like, Ebert is a liker of Lynch.
He can grow.
I think I get it, though. I get where Ebert's coming from, because I have, you know, delicate sensibilities about this kind of shit. I'm a very harsh judge of the gaze being explored within film, of sexualized violence being explored in film. I've just seen enough of it at this point in my life. I've known enough people who've lived with it that, like, it makes me, like, really, I put on my little hater's hat when it happens in a movie. And I do, like, think this film, the assault that's depicted in this film is honestly mild compared to the assault that's depicted in Blue Velvet.
Yes.
In some ways. But it's still very, very unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And I do think the film, I don't know. I'm still trying to decide how I feel about the scene between Lula and Bobby Peru, because it is really upsetting. But I think he manages to thread the needle fairly well as far as putting you in Lula's skin and making you feel that discomfort, but not making the scene feel exploitative. Kind of gets at sort of, you know, assaults are not always a physical beating. Sure. Sometimes there's a psychological battle taking place. And I think that scene kind of gets at that idea in an interesting way.
When you talk about getting in Lula's skin, and I think we do, we feel her suffering, and, you know, we want the three clicks of the heels to get her out of there too.
Yeah,
you know, like that sort of last moment of that scene. But also, I think it puts us in Bobby Peru's skin in an interesting way, where it shows how little it really matters to Bobby, because you know, he finally gets her there and, like, well, maybe later, bye.
Yeah,
and just because it is
it's just a game to him.
It's just a game, and I think the repulsiveness of that sort of if he had gone ahead and gone through with the act, I think it would have been much more misogynistic.
Oh, I think the film would not work. I think it would kill the movie. And absolutely,
you know. But rather by just letting it be, just like, you know, it's another thing. Mm-hmm. And it, because for him, if they had gone all the way, it would have been just another thing. Yeah. If she'd beat him up and left him bleeding, it would just been another thing. And
that'd have been another possible outcome. Yeah, and he's not really concerned with the outcome.
He doesn't. The very little regard he has to other human beings, as particularly women, is the evidence that's on display there in that scene. And so I think it's a powerful moment of sort of empathy and repulsion.
We also have, I guess, the other scene we should bring up that's been heavily cut, not the Bobby Peru head explosion, but the torture and death of Johnny Farragut, played by Harry Dean Stanton. It was apparently, you know, much longer. I forget the name of the actress that plays Juana, but I guess she had a whole monologue.
Grace Zabrinsky.
She had a whole monologue that got cut because test audiences were just like, there was like this very sexual encounter after she kills Harry Dean Stanton.
Because she's very, very, very aroused.
For the murder.
Doing the thing.
But again, like, playing into this idea of, like, you know, the relationships between men and women, and sort of the loaded nature of those relationships. Like, there's definitely something interesting going on with this, like, sexualized murder of a man by a woman. That, again, we don't get in the finished film, but I am, like, interested in that. That's part of the soup that he's playing with. Like, that's an ingredient that he wanted in the film. And I think, you know, that's a smart filmmaker to say, okay, we've tried this at two different test screenings and it's not working. We gotta get rid of this.
Do something else,
We gotta do something else and change the feel of the scene.
Well, it's 100. It was an hour and 15 minutes of cut and extended scenes on the Blu-ray. I mean, there's always a full other movie. You know, the missing pieces of Twin Peaks is off. I mean, you know, he's
not quite like Malick, but
he's not a self-indulgent director. Is the thing. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and he's willing to leave good stuff on the floor if it doesn't quite work for the finished product. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, I invoke Malick just to, you know, it's not as lyrical, and it's like not filming a bunch of stuff to find the movie in the edit. It is a little bit more structured than that.
Yeah.
And this is like a very linear and structured film for Lynch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's as far as, like, do you think it's because it's based on a novel? Do you think, I know
the
novel
is not very linear.
Yeah. You mentioned it's very vignette heavy.
I think, in fact, David gives it more structure.
That's so interesting.
Than it had. Yeah.
Which, again, is not his normal lane. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess Twin Peaks, you know, when it is being a broadcast network television crime procedural is kind of linear.
Sure.
But like he, you know, he loves messing with perspective and time and reality. So it's interesting, like the weirdest we get here as far as like reality is like Visions of Fire, Glinda the Good Witch. Like it's grounded for him as fantastical as it goes, which is, I think, interesting. It, you know, as a Lynch lover yourself, like, is that what draws you to this film? Is sort of the ways in which it's a little different for him?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously, the award, honestly, is the first thing. It's like, I have to see this one because it's the one that won, you know, the one that's ever won a best picture of any form. Yeah, you know, this is the one to see. So in some minds, this is the best thing he's ever done. Mm-hmm. All right, let's find out. And so that, I mean, that's sort of what sparks the initial interest. I think what keeps me coming back is the way in which it's able to switch registers between that sort of high Nick Cage insanity to something that's really kind of tender, you know, and kind of true. And that both of those things can sort of coexist. And his ability to sort of walk that tonal edge is what keeps me coming back, I think.
I think we should mention for the listeners' context. This was, you have a host pick this month, and this was going to be your pick if Arthur didn't program.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I get why now. I definitely do. It's like really, really exhilarating, really interesting. You know what I keep thinking about is when Marietta's on the phone when a sailor calls the house, and then Laura Dern's at the top of the stairs doing this weird arm behind the head thing.
Yeah, like, which is a constant slamming out.
Yeah, just like, you can't keep me away from me. It's just like so arch and so melodramatic, and she's killing it.
Yeah,
she's
so good.
They're both so hot in this movie. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's crazy. Do we want to talk about, you know, pumping?
They do it.
I mean, do you talk about sex in film and like the way it's used in this film and like to what end? Because obviously we've talked about sort of the grimier side of sexuality in this film. So maybe we can kind of go a little light for a second.
Yeah, sure. I don't know if I have any comment on it other than it is. The choices are pretty visceral. Let's say it that way.
I mean, it's obviously, you know, there's a fairly famous sex scene in Mulholland Drive. But as far as my knowledge goes, this is like his horniest movie by a pretty wide margin. Maybe it's because it's a love story.
You haven't seen Lost Highway yet.
That's true. But I guess, I mean, as far as like, but this being a love story, I guess, is sort of.
And I think the use of sexuality, different than what we see in Lost Highway, the sexuality here is to show that not only is there something, there's a strange spiritual connection between, it's not strange, but sweet spiritual connection between Sailor and Lula, that they do genuinely love each other. They do share each other's stories. There's a way in which they sort of know each other's souls, but the way in which he wants to embody that, and sexuality becomes the embodiment of what's already going on emotionally, spiritually between the two characters. And so, and that there's, even though it is that connection, there's still something animalistic about it all.
Yeah, it gets something about like young relationships, right? That sort of like primal hormonal, like can't keep our hands off of each other. But you're right though. I think that's a good way to put it. It embodies this sort of spiritual, like, you know, psychological connection that they have really well.
I wish I had a reading on the color coding for the sort of,
I'm sure it's on a Reddit somewhere,
the gel wipes, but I don't have a reading. I don't know what the yellow to the green, you know, I don't know what that means.
I like how sort of dreamy and impressionistic the sex scenes are. Sort of, they're very rarely like, you know, grounded and like you're in the room. They're very kind of glossy and not quite, you know, gauzy lens sort of old Hollywood, but like kind of in that register in some ways. I don't know, we're kind of running long, but this is such a dense text that I'm having fun talking about. Do we have anything that we got to hit before we get out of here?
I don't think we have to directly bring attention to at this point. Let's go ahead and render us a verdict, shall we? Shelf or trash, Arthur, what do you say?
I think, I mean,
that's your choices too, because there's no scream.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't do that anyway because I don't cop out.
He's not a coward like us.
This is not for everybody, but it's for me. And so for that, and just pure accessibility, I would easily shelf this.
Very good. What do you say, Dalton?
Well, the editor of this film said his granny went to see it, and she called him And she would have been like in her 80s at the time.
I saw the story.
Did you see the story? And he was like, "Grandma, what do you mean you went and saw my new movie that I edited? Why did you do that?" And she said, "Oh no, I loved it. It reminded me of when I was a teenager." And
why is your grandma David Lynch?
I know everybody's David Lynch in this marathon for me. You're right, though. That was my David Lynch impression. But I get that and I agree with it. This movie reminds me of being a teenager in all the right ways. It reminds me of being an American in all the right ways. I'm with Arthur. It's for me. And thank you to our patrons for putting it on my shelf.
Yes.
And allowing us to cover this film. Really appreciate it, guys.
I had not gotten around to buying it because I had acquired it through other means in various ways over the years to get to watch it. And I am also grateful to our patrons because I think it absolutely is worthy of being on the shelf. I put all the Lynch on the shelf, but this is in the top. This is the Mount Rushmore of the Lynch movies.
And shout out to Shout Factory Select for this pretty, well done. Pretty good print.
They put a lot of good stuff out. I really am impressed with them.
Yeah.
So there you go, dear listener. We're probably wrong about everything we said about Wild at Heart. I'm sure David Lynch would think so. If you have David Lynch's corrections and you want to bring them to us from your transcendental meditations.
David, if you want to come and talk to us.
You're more than welcome.
Holy shit, I want to talk about the weather with David Lynch so bad.
I mean, absolutely.
Just like rip some Mar rolls with him.
Just
a thermos full of coffee.
What a time. But if you want to tell us, Dalton's going to tell you how you can tell us we're wrong.
If you've got David Lynch's contact info, you can send it to goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. I'm sure he would hate the idea of people making him talk about his movie for an hour, but I'm sure he would be delighted to hear about people talking about the movie for an hour because, as he says, the films speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's... Yeah, give us your thoughts. How does this film speak for itself? How does David Lynch speak to you or not speak to you? Because he has his detractors, and I think they all have some good points.
A lot of people hate this movie.
Yeah, and I think good points. So goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com for that feedback. If you want to find us casually on the internet, we're all on Letterboxd. He's Dustin Sells. He's the Arthur Gordon. I always get this wrong. You are the Arthur Gordon. I'm Dollywood Squares, but I think if you do my first last name, I still come up. And then I'm on Insta, Dollywood Squares. Arthur's maybe revitalizing our Instagram account. I saw a post.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. Maybe.
If we have time. We have day jobs and lives, and we're at Good Trash Media all over the internet, wherever you want to find us. We're just not prolific posters anymore. If you want to find written content from all three of us, mostly Dustin and some friends of the network, you can go to goodtrashmedia.com to find some written content if that's what your deal is. We also have other shows that we support and work with, The Wheel of Randy with Dan Wade, where you can hear discussions about Randy Newman songs, both originals and covers. And then you can also check out The Praise Down with Heath and Alex. They're not regularly releasing episodes of late, but they've got 100 plus in the can, and they're all really interesting. They, explore Christian media, interview people about their spiritual journeys and their relationships to Christian music and media. It's a cool show, The Praise Down with Heath and Alex. Last but certainly not least, if you want to support us and what we do over here, you can go to patreon.com/GTM. That's Good Trash Media, GT/GTM, to find out what's in it for you. We can send you a movie. You can pick a movie for us to talk about on the show. All kinds of things. Patreon.com/GTM for more info on that. Arthur, we've got 3 more weeks of David Lynch to go and only so many more movies on the filmography. And we certainly won't be covering Mulholland Drive because we've talked about it before.
We won't be doing Eraserhead because we've also done it.
Yeah. My dear Arthur, are we talking about next week?
Well, as we continue to move through the Black Lodge, the giant directs us and lets us know that we must get back out on the road.
No.
And so next week, we discuss maybe the most Lynch film when we get on our lawnmowers and talk about The Straight Story.
Wow, you.
With our good friend, Dan Bokemper.
Wow, you were just...
That was an emotional roller coaster.
I thought I was going to have to watch all of Twin Peaks.
Oh, I thought I was thinking it was going to be Fire Walk With Me.
Well, that's what I mean, but yeah. I can't watch Fire Walk With Me if I haven't watched all of Twin Peaks.
Probably not.
So I really thought it was Fire Walk With Me for a second, and then I thought it was Lost Highway. That was a journey.
Wow.
I cannot believe we're talking straight. I had a feeling you would program Straight Story.
It's
I'm
so
glad
good.
You did.
It's so strange in his filmography, but it's so good.
I'm stoked. And Bo Kemper's going to be on for that one. Is Bo Kemper a Straight Story fan?
Yeah, it's the one he picked.
That's awesome.
I gave him the list of movies we were doing, and this is the one he wanted to talk about.
That's so good. I'm so glad we're doing it, though. I mean, honestly, completionism, it makes sense. Yeah, I'm there for it.
We have to see all facets of the man. And yeah, getting the studio one in quotes with Dune, getting the normal one in quotes with Straight Story on either side of the Palme d'Or winner. That's just good programming. I love Arthur Gordon. What can I say?
Yeah, he's a smart guy.
Well, you want to hear us kiss each other on the mouth some more and tell each other how much we like each other? Tune in next week, I guess.
Yeah, you keep watching. We'll keep talking, and we'll see you all next time.
I'm not afraid.